Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, a podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen O'Donoghue and I am a novelist, a journalist and someone who spends a lot of her time reading about sexy people kissing. Today I've invited literary agent and writer Abigail Bergstrom to talk about the 2006 mega hit travel memoir Eat, Pray, Love. Abigail, thank you so much for coming. Welcome.
Woo, thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
I generally ask people at this juncture what made you choose this book, but actually I made you choose this book.
I was like, oh.
I just texted you out of the blue to say, will you do this? And I did it because we went for dinner about a year ago.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And we were quite drunk on the tube home. And I don't
sounds
know.
About right.
I don't know what brought it up. But someone, like one of us said Elizabeth Gilbert. And then the other person just leaned in being like,
oh my
I
God.
Love her.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite representative of Liz Gilbert and Eat, Pray, Love in that, like, it's become so much of a cliche that you can only bring it up when you're pissed and there's only two of you.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, it kind of is. Otherwise, you feel a bit like, oh, I'm embarrassed. Like Jodie Pico, I feel like she's similar to that as well. Like, I love Jodie Pico, but I feel like I'm not allowed to admit that to people.
Is that how you pronounce her last name?
Yeah.
I was always saying pickle.
Oh, pickle.
With a silent T.
I think the T is silent. You got that bit right. Or we're both wrong, in which case, I'm sorry, everybody.
Many people already know the plot, Eat, Pray, Love, but I'm going to give a quick summary just for the uninitiated. So this is actually the first memoir in the series that we've done so far. So Liz Gilbert is a journalist who, following a divorce, a breakup, and a long depression, decides to go traveling for a year to Italy, India, and Indonesia. And that's basically it. We learn about pleasure in Italy. We learn about spiritual enlightenment in India, and we learn about Indonesia and Indonesia.
Yeah, yeah. Balance. Indonesia's about balance.
Yeah. So what is your experience of this book? Tell me a little bit about it.
So I read this book when I just graduated, and I've kind of moved to Hong Kong, and I was doing a little bit of traveling around Southeast Asia, and I was about to go to Bali, funnily enough. So I picked this book up and read it then. So I was actually sort of having a year out before I got my first job, and
sure.
You know, was traveling. And
what year was this? So how much of a cliche was Eat, Pray, Love already by the time you read it?
I mean, this was probably about 8 years ago, nine years ago, maybe. So yeah, I think it just come out and there was a lot of hype around it. When was it published?
2006.
Okay.
And then I think the movie with Julia Roberts came fairly quickly afterwards. So we're talking like the late 2000s, early 2010s. That's the moment it's really raining.
Yeah.
About 5 years there. Yeah. So yeah, this seems about right.
I think it just come out. And I was kind of going through a breakup myself and was kind of had removed myself from it and was, you know, really far away. And so, yeah, I think I just related to it on many, many levels, particularly the amount of pasta she eats in Italy.
So much. And she really doesn't mince with the pasta at all. You really get to know that pasta.
Yes.
Some would say that the pasta is a second character of the book.
Oh my God. Totally. And the dough. The pizza dough?
The dough. I always, whenever I see, if I find really good pizza, when she talks about like how the pizza was so good, it was almost like naan.
Yes.
And I always think about what must that be like? Like it's so light and so fluffy that it's like naan.
Yeah.
But it's pizza.
Exactly. Like she thought pizza doughs could either be kind of thin and crunchy or like fat and doughy. She didn't realize they could be thin and doughy.
Yeah.
And you're like, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't know that either. Where do I get that?
And she also describes like her physical body as being both thin and doughy, which is also something I relate to.
Yeah. Yeah.
In that like far away, I appear like a thin woman, but actually there's a lot of...
When you get a bit closer, it's like soft, all good dough over here.
Yeah. Good swiggling dough.
Yeah.
Swiggling.
Oh, good word.
I think I had a similar experience with this book. I haven't really done a lot of traveling per se, but I had the thing of having a lot of audiobook credits And I had read Signature of All Things, which is her novel that wasn't as successful as this, but is a really brilliant novel. But I was after a breakup, and I heard that Eat, Pray, Love was the quintessential breakup memoir. And so I was like, you know what? I'm almost going to ironically listen to this in audiobook. And then 2 hours later, and I'm just weeping on the train while this woman slowly coos me into through my sorrow. Because like I think it's what people underestimate the most about this book is that, yes, okay, she does all the traveling, she does all this eating, this praying or whatever, and she writes about it brilliantly, and it's because she writes about it brilliantly that it's been sold so much. But the very real sorrow at the beginning of this book, and it's a big chunk of the book, is you really get to grips with how terribly sad this woman is.
Yeah. She's depressed. She's, you know, she's battling with depression and
a very real depression.
Yeah, and even, you know, in no amount of traveling to, you know, can ease that really. She goes to Italy and it follows her there, and it's something that she has to overcome herself, I think, rather than through the art of travel. But yeah, it's kind of heartbreaking but relatable in the way that she talks about her pain in such kind of raw honesty.
Because she has this, we meet her and she is on the bathroom floor crying.
Yes.
And even saying on the bathroom, like, it's such a cliche in itself.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I'm crying on the bathroom floor. But like, it's so very real. And she's in this marriage she doesn't want to be anymore. And I think this bit, regardless of whether you've ever even left the country in your life, this bit where she's like, you know, I met my husband, we agreed that our 20s would be crazy, and by 30 we would try for a baby, and all I want to do is just run to Greenland.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to have this baby. I don't want to live here. I don't want to be in this marriage. And like, I think everyone's had that thing of like, I don't think the woman I'm meant to be is a woman I can be physically. I think it actually revolts me being this thing that people want me to be, and whatever that thing is, you know?
Definitely. And I love the bit where she kind of talks about, she looks around, she's like, I actively partook in the creation of this life.
Yeah.
I chose it. I held his hand, and step by step, I took all, you know, I took each step to creating this. It was what I wanted to. I was willful in it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Now all of a sudden I've changed my mind, which I think is kind of fascinating in terms of the framework that we put on women today. And I think a lot of women maybe don't question that social framework. They don't ask, you know, do I really want to get married? What does that mean? They don't ask themselves, like, do I really want a baby? Like, how will that affect my life and my identity and how, you know, my body and how I think? I think sometimes we just do things because it's ingrained in us.
Yeah.
It's so kind of embedded that we forget to question it. We just make this assumption and we go along with our lives. And Elizabeth Gilbert feels like she's almost a culprit of that.
Yeah.
And I think now more than ever today, you know, as women, we have more choices, more options, and we are starting to question that. And, you know, the whole Refinery 29 thing, not when, if, in terms of having a baby, you know, and the way that we have a dialogue around it. Whereas I guess in her time, it wasn't if you have a baby, it was when you have a baby.
And this is 10 years ago. Like, this is not,
yeah,
this is like not the 80s or even, you know.
No.
But then, you know, there's always that thing of like, oh yeah, we're all about choices. We're all about career. A woman can do anything, but there's no, you can't outrun your own clock. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can't outrun the fact that it will get harder after a certain age or whatever.
Yeah.
So we're just, I often feel, and this is a little bit of a tangent, but I often feel that, so I'm 28 and how old are you?
30.
30. Great.
Yeah.
And all the women I know in my life are achieving at their highest possible level all the time. I have, you know, playwright friends and author friends, and I don't worry about, the only thing, when I'm ever worrying about them, it's that they're working too hard.
Yeah.
Most of my male friends aren't achieving to that level. And that's a, I'm not being mean, but they aren't achieving that level, and they also don't care, you know? They're like, yeah, it's okay, you know, life is long and, you know, whatever. And I think it's because women have this sense that, like, I have to do everything by the time I'm 35, 36, 37. So by the time I walk away from the table to have a baby and come back 6 months later, like, they'll have to have me, you know?
Yeah.
And I think with Liz Gilbert, you get the sense that she did achieve a huge amount.
Mm-hmm.
Like, her career, like, she, by the time she's 30, she's written 3 books.
Yeah.
She is a well-paid GQ and Esquire interviewer, features writer. She's been all over the world.
She's a playwright.
She's a playwright.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. It's like, she was very well-respected before Eat, Pray, Love even happened.
Yeah.
Like, she was well-paid, a successful person.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
I can't even remember what tangent I'm going on, but I think I just...
Well, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of like, I was kind of feel like I'm having an existential crisis listening to you talk about that, because, you know, I feel the same as that. And when, you know, I think about my female friends as well, and I've kind of always been like rushing, like do well, achieve, ambition, like,
yeah,
where's
I'm
my next stack on the ladder?
Yeah.
And I've never ever once thought in my life that maybe on some conscious level that was because I've thought if I do want to have a family, you know, those things are going to be sacrificed or jeopardized or just maybe potentially slowed down purely because of the, you know, biological and sometimes mental restrictions when you have a baby, I suppose, too. But yeah, that is really fascinating. And like one of my favorite, I think there's a lot of dialogue at the moment around women and whether or not they want to have children.
Yeah.
I don't know if you read Sheila Hattie's book, Motherhood, where it's like the whole book is an internal monologue of her trying to decipher whether or not she wants to be a mother.
Wow.
It's
that book has been recommended to me loads of times, but I never knew that was what was it about.
Yeah.
Because it looks very serious and I'm kind of like,
no,
summertime, you know.
It's amazing. You're just like trapped in her head and her kind of grappling with this and whether it is something she wants or isn't. But I love in the book that Elizabeth Gilbert's sister says to her, she's like, having a baby is like getting a tattoo on your head. Like, you kind of have to be sure.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I don't know. It's
in that same chapter, she says something like, I got so excited when I got a commission from an editor to go see jellyfish spawning in Brazil, and I couldn't feel even an iota of the same excitement about the prospect of having a baby.
Literally. And then she's like, until I can feel as excited about a baby as like going all this way to see jellyfish, then I probably shouldn't have one.
Yeah.
And she talks about travel. You know, she says, I feel the same way about travel as people do about their babies. Like, I don't care. She says in the book, I don't care if it's hard. I don't care if it makes me cry or sometimes like I'm really struggling. I see myself in it and I love it. And to me, traveling is like, you know, how a lot of my friends feel about their babies.
That is so true, because it sounds like a weirdly facetious thing to say, because obviously they're very different things
that.
But like, actually, when you get down to it,
there's
a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of cliches around like, oh, my books are my babies, you know.
Yeah.
But in a way, I also feel that way. It's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason, because I do find truth in it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, I bet. I mean, yeah, I can imagine, and kind of birthing it, and then I always think of that analogy as well when it kind of gets published and suddenly it's like your firstborn going off into the world and you're like, I have no control over that. I can't do it. You know, you're like, you're at God's will. Like, I can't do anything.
I know.
I think it's a good analogy, although I admit, very, very different.
Exactly. What I find really interesting is that Liz Gilbert's entire career is almost the reverse of most, I'm going to say chick lit in inverted commas, authors.
Mm-hmm.
Because she started out modeling herself on Hemingway, and her whole thing was that she wrote like a man, also in inverted commas, and that she would follow people on, she would like befriend Colombian drug lords and like do, like look at manly men doing manly things. One of her first books, The Last American Man, was just her following this like cowboy all around America. And people really respected her because she wrote in this very lean, masculine way.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Really? Yeah, no. She like, people talk about, oh, why was she given this huge advance? She had been nominated for a National Book Award at 27,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
That's why she was given a huge advance.
Yeah.
But then she became this global mega hit with Eat, Pray, Love.
Yeah.
And she was then considered a chick lit author, a woman's author. And she's been just released her, well, she's releasing her next novel in June of this year. And that is literally a frothy novel about showgirls.
Right.
So she's kind of like, she started on this very masculine trajectory and then she went further into this like very feminine one.
That's interesting.
You know?
I wonder whether that was out of choice or whether, you know, she's sort of been steered in that direction off the back of the success of Eat, Pray, Love.
I think it's like once you suddenly go to, once you go from having a book launch and or a book signing and maybe there's 30 people there and they saw a nice write-up in the New York Times of your book or whatever, to it's been in every magazine, there are queues out the door. Like, people used to, like, go to New Jersey just to find her.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
there was a, you know, she moved so many people, I guess, that I don't...
Like, literally physically moved them, you know?
Yeah, for sure. And I always, like, what is it, do you think, that makes this book so special? Like, what is that je ne sais quoi that just made it resonate so much? Like, I often, I mean, I suppose it's kind of maybe it's a personal question, it's different for everyone, but is there something universal in it that we all connected with? For me, this idea of, I guess, religion, like, you know, religion is a kind of very controversial and complicated thing, especially in America. And she created this idea that you could just cherry pick your religion. You could just choose. But if you were born Catholic, you decided that that wasn't right for you, you weren't able to kind of find or connect with God there, you could go and you could just try something else, and you were allowed and free and able to do that. And I think she was one of the first people to introduce that idea to me.
Idea
that I could just pick. Before that, it would have felt disrespectful or on some level wrong. And I think she changed people's minds on that, maybe, or just lifted her hand up and went, but what if we just decide ourselves and choose? And I think that is something that's really powerful about the book.
Definitely. And I think what she does with it is very clever, because she start out and it's a depressed lady, and then she goes to Italy.
Yeah.
And that Italy is the first stop on her whistle stop tour of the world.
Yes.
And it's all stuff that's really easy to relate to, because everybody likes food.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If you don't like food, you're a knob. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you just get all these very incredibly graphic, sensual explanations of pasta and pastries and pizza and all these beautiful things. And everyone she meets is sort of sexy and fun.
Yeah.
And you're so there with her. And because, like, maybe as Europeans as well, we've both been to Italy. Like, most people we know have been to Italy, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We kind of, we see it, we have a reference, and we're kind of, we get very comfortable with that. And then she goes to India, and she uses the exact same methods, the detail, the sensualness, the kind of the graphicness of everything, but talking about prayer and her relationship to God.
Yeah.
And because you're already with her, you're like, well, this is not really, you know, I don't generally read about this kind of thing, but I guess I'll keep reading. You get into sucked into thinking about your own relationship with God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what's your relationship with God?
Yeah. Is that a question?
I guess, what is it?
Wow. I guess I do subscribe to this idea that she presents, which is, you know, the idea of God being something that's inside us and something that's internal. And in building and growing that relationship, you look inwards. I guess my relationship with God...
See, it's embarrassing to talk about, isn't it? It feels embarrassing.
It does. It does feel embarrassing, yeah. Because I guess the kind of Western framework around talking about God doesn't really fit for me. But then there's something that's a bit kind of eye roll about the whole kind of spirituality of and talking about God in that sense that we... So, yeah, it does.
Yeah.
It feels sticky. It feels sticky because it's controversial, and it feels sticky because there's a lot of eye rolling around the type of God that she relates to, which is this like inner experience with herself that she finds through meditation and she finds through devotion, and she finds really from cutting herself off from the real world. You know, she leaves everything behind her. She's in this ashram, you know, for 3-4 months, doesn't leave or see anything else, which is a pretty extreme way to access God as well. I mean, what's your relationship with God? Like,
It's definitely changes a lot, I think, because I grew up Catholic and in Ireland as well. And that's like a different kind of experience because my parents weren't particularly religious. Uh-huh. But everything in Ireland is informed by the church in some kind of a trickle down way, in that like it's kind of just part of everything.
Yeah.
But, it's a very hard thing to explain. And I've only started thinking about like, what are my private terms with God in the last few years? And again, I feel very uncomfortable thinking about it because straight atheism just feels so arrogant.
Yeah.
You know, just to be like, well, obviously we're all just animals lumping around like fucking and eating. Like, I don't think I ever want to be that cynical to just think that.
No.
And, the way that she talks about it in the book is that she, a lovely way of putting it, where she says, I want to experience God like a river experiences sunlight on the top of, like sunlight plays across a river kind of thing.
Yeah, the dappling of light on the river. And I want him to be in my veins. And
And she said something about like there's like, and I think I've borrowed this for several, I think I've like literally plagiarized this for like bits, but like amazing. She said something about, I believe that there is a silver strand going through the universe that is connecting us somehow in some unspeakable way, and I want to feel it more.
Yeah.
She just wants to feel God. And it's such a weird thing for like a successful journalist lady from New York who like is quippy and fun to just be that serious about.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. She writes about it in a way where I don't know, you don't eye roll. That's the trick of it. Like you say, she draws you in from the beginning and then she goes on this like spiritual journey and you literally go along with her and you take it at face value. Like when she's like, everything is God. Coral is God.
Yeah.
Flowers are God. You know, the clouds are God. I am also God, except I'm human. So I've been blessed with the consciousness to be able to pursue and understand and have a relationship with. And that's kind of... It sounds exciting.
It does sound exciting. And and you do... So when she's in the ashram in India, and she's very realistic about it, she's like, I feel like I'm... She's like constantly trying to reach something. It's like... It almost reminds me of... You know when like you're with a partner who you can't quite reach orgasm with? That's like almost 2 months of India. It's like almost, but no.
Yeah.
At the last minute, someone changes position and everything's weird.
Totally. But also, you know, when you like get to that point, because she says like the ego and think when she gets these places, like saying I think or I want, like that release of ego stops it. It's like when you're having sex 70 and you're like, oh no, it's happening. It's coming. It's like, oh no, it's not. Now I'm thinking about it. And I've ruined it. No, it's not. Totally.
Yeah. She like glimpses like divinity. Then she's like, and she's like, oh, I wanted to do more of this. And then she's like,
and she's like,
out of it.
Very weird. I want. I like that's it. I just feel myself being pulled back because it's like the resurfacing of her ego, of which like there's no room for that to exist in divinity and in that experience of heaven through meditation.
Right. And like, I feel like if you're listening to this as a listener and you haven't read this book, you'll be like, what the fuck is this book?
Yeah, no. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Because even like when... And this kind of segues quite nicely into the reputation that this book has. Because before you got here, me and my producer Hannah were talking and she was like, is this book actually good? Because I only know it as a joke.
Yeah.
And I think that's how a lot of people know it.
Yeah.
I think partly because the title of the book is so kind of weird and funny almost.
Yeah.
Because I think whenever anyone now does like a travel memoir, it's like, oh, eat, pray, shit.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. I think that's part of it. But like what you, I mean, you are a literary agent. You worked in the book trade your entire life.
Yeah.
What do you think happened with this book, both in the boom of it and in the like the cultural joke of it?
I think when anything reaches that level of success, then it's, you know, prime ripe fodder for mockery and parody. And, you know, I think that's true of like all like many different versions of art, I suppose. Why it really took off, again, I think the way that, as I said earlier, kind of the way that she grappled with and talked about religion, I think was quite kind of, I don't know, not new, but relatable. It was relatable. She stopped you from eye rolling. Like you say, like she took you to Italy and she got you on board. And then before you know it, you're like, yeah, I should sit down and meditate for 3 hours and connect with God. That feels like something that I could and should do.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's also books about heartbreak. I mean, that kind of, that deep sorrow. I mean, everybody has had their heart broken.
Everybody had a David.
Everybody. And even if, you know, even if you've broken your own heart, you know, even if your heart hasn't been broken by romantic love, it's been broken by a kind of, you know, career failure or something that you wanted to do that you didn't. Mm. Everyone understands what heartbreak it's like. And it's fucking horrific. And it is all consuming. And it takes over. And I think in this book, she is there with you. She is there with you. And she's, you know, you feel less alone, I guess, in that pain and sorrow. One of the things that really, really stayed with me from it was when she's with Richard from Texas.
Richard from Texas.
Who we have to come back to because I'm literally obsessed with Richard from Texas.
Oh my God.
But when
a guru himself.
Yeah, and she's in India and he's like, come on, you need to focus on, you know, let go of David. Something about David. You need to focus on meeting with God. You need to focus on your meditation. Like, why are you making your life and everything you feel about him? And she's like, I love that. I love him. And he's like, yeah. So love him.
So love him.
So love him. And she's like, well, but I really miss him. And he's like, yeah. So miss him. It's like, miss him, love him, feel all of those feelings, send them to him, and then think about something else.
Oh, God.
And just like this idea that you can still love and miss someone, even when you can't be with them or it hasn't worked out or you've caused each other intense pain, that you can still, that you don't need their permission.
Yeah, right?
You can just love them.
It is a very powerful idea. It feels very Oprah, but when you're, again, once you're in it, and Richard from Texas is this very interesting character who, just for listeners, when Liz is in the ashram in India, she meets this Richard from Texas, who I think she says at the beginning of the book, it is the only name in the book she hasn't changed because he wanted to be included.
Which isn't true, because Kutut's name is Kutut.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think that both time I read it. She does say that, and I'm like, that's not true. Kutut's called Kutut. I'm like, come on,
well, I have a good tits right to privacy, man. My man. But Richard from Texas, then he is just a sage. He's like a guy who's been divorced several times, and he's got like, you know, he's had several different lives, and now he's just doing yoga as a thing. And you, and like, he pops up on the first chapter of the India book.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, this guy seems colourful.
Richard's opening line is, "Jesus, they've got mosquitoes around here big enough to rape a chicken." And I think that epitomizes Richard.
Right?
Yeah.
And when you're like, oh, he's going to be this colourful character that makes sure that I'm not too bored during these meditation chapters. Yeah. But then he becomes this, like, philosophical force.
Yeah.
Like, and that same bit that you were talking about like, oh, you know, I love him, so love him, I miss him, so miss him.
Yeah.
He says to her, you're like an old, and I've felt this way so many times in my life, though. You're like an old dog at the dump who's just licking at an empty can when there's no nutrition left, and now you're going to get it stuck on your snout forever.
Yeah.
I was like, I have been that lady.
Yeah. Like, he's like, don't make your life a monument to David. And
right?
You're like, yeah. It's just, oh my God.
So woke.
Also, let's talk about Richard from Texas on Soulmates.
Yes. Yes. Yes, yes. I think I actually wrote it down.
This is when he's basically like, you're not meant to end up with your soulmates. Your soulmates are meant to come in. They're meant to break your ego, push down your boundaries, rip you apart, and show you something about yourself. They're meant to teach you something. Like, there's this kind of obsession with being with your soulmate. And he's just like, no, you're not meant to be with your soulmate. Your soulmates are sent to fuck
soulmate
your life
up. Soulmate is a mirror.
They're a mirror. Yeah, they're a mirror. And they're meant to break you down, and then in doing that, you learn something about yourself, which fundamentally changes the way that you live, and that's like what they're sent to do. And you, like, the person you end up with is, you know, somebody that you love, but it's not a soulmate.
Yeah,
and I just love that. I think that's
a fantastic
idea. So true. I think these like extreme loves or infatuation or the relationships that sometimes hurt us the most really cast us into something new. And then when you're in a relationship kind of that's maybe meant to be, you know, more long term, or somebody that might be a forever person, it's more like, you know, two puzzles coming together.
Right.
Where they slot in, as opposed to a mirror where you're like, whoa, you know?
It makes so much sense to me, kind of thing. Because, like, of course, you can't stay with someone whose job in life is to reflect your... Unless you're like into self-harm.
Well, he's like, that's
to reflect the worst things about you.
Totally.
Yeah.
Being with your soulmate is just painful. Why would you want that?
Yeah. But also, it's such a good...
Isn't it interesting? Like the mirror kind of idea, because it's like you say, it's reflecting back the most kind of awful things about yourself. But also it's like this infatuation is also with yourself. Like it's not just you falling in love with that person. It's like you falling in love with a version of you.
It really is that.
Which I think what, that, you know, that's what
everyone's done that
is.
At least once, haven't they?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.
Liz Gilbert is probably one of my favorite living writers.
Yeah.
Which is a big thing to say. I read a lot of fucking books.
Yeah.
But even I, like, sometimes flip back and forth over... She can be a little bit cringy about herself, right?
Mm-hmm.
She can really do this thing where she's like, she'll go on these long explanations over how likable she is.
Yeah.
Where she's like, don't you understand? That doesn't make you likable for you to talk about how naturally gregarious that you are.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then at the same time, she's like, listen, I can make friends with anyone. I'm not worried about going to Indonesia because I will have a best friend in 10 days. And you're like, okay, bitch.
Yeah, I know.
And there's bits of... in a way, this is going to be a little bit out there, but like, Ypres Love almost acts as a mirror in itself, in that there are so many times when I'm reading it, even though I love it as a book, where I feel uncomfortable, jealous, angry, or annoyed with literally Liz Gilbert herself.
Yeah, I agree.
Because there are things she's doing I want to do. Yeah. There are ways she is that I want to be. And also there are ways she is that I know I'm like and I wish I wasn't.
And it's
like
ugly. That kind of...
It is ugly.
Yeah, that self-indulgence and that kind of... Yeah, everybody is cares and is interested in me and every single tiny thought that crosses my mind.
Yes.
And I am the center of the universe.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's kind of like, I mean, dare I say it, but I'm gonna. It's like Carrie Bradshaw in like Sex and the City. If you watch enough episodes in a row, then you're like, Jesus, Carrie, shut up. Not the whole world's about you, Carrie. But yeah, I do see that. I do see that. But also, yeah.
And there's this weird flip side to her. I really felt this, where it was, you know, she talks about her, you know, like ability and her gregariousness, and you're like, all right, queen. But then she talks about the sort of flip side of that exact same quality, which is that she falls in love with people really quickly. And then, like, her friend says to her, you're like a dog. You start looking exactly like them. And she just basically subsumes her entire personality into men she meets, you know? And I was like, oh, God, that is me. Like, there's a bit I marked out that I have here. And that I literally started cringing in my bones when I was reading.
Read it.
Yeah. I have a history of making decisions very quickly about men. I have always fallen in love fast and without measuring risks. I have a tendency not only to see the best in everyone, but to assume that everyone is emotionally capable of reaching his highest potential. I have fallen in love more times than I care to count with the highest potential of a man rather than with the man himself. And I have hung on to that relationship for a long time, sometimes far too long, waiting for the man to ascend to his own greatness. Many times in romance, I have been victim of my own optimism.
Oh.
And I was like, oh God, there's so many people who have stayed with for so long. And I've been like, oh, but like, don't you think he could be a great writer one day?
Yeah.
And it's like,
yeah. Because you see yourself in that you've done that, you mean?
Yeah.
That you've like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely. But I think that's it's a real, like, I don't feel the Liz Gilbert now today does that.
No.
Like, that's her whole journey, isn't it? That she has to be able to be on her own and be enough in order for them when she, you know, as cliche as that is, in order for them when she meets somebody to be like, actually, no, you're not really what I'm after right now, or you're not really good enough. But that idea of a man, you know, giving a man space to rise to his highest potential, do you think that's something that's been ingrained in mainstream media and the Happily Ever After, where we're like, it'll all come good in the end?
Yes.
You know, Mr. Big will show up and propose and...
But
you know?
I think this is a phrase that I've seen a lot sort of online, but that whole thing of like women as daycare centres for unreliable men.
Yes.
So the thing like that, like... And I had this argument with my mother a lot because I've got two older brothers, and whenever they've had like, you know, pretty wild years in their lives or whatever, or things weren't going well for them, it'll always come down to if he just met someone, or, you know, and if he just met a girl who was a bit like this and a bit like this.
Yeah.
And I've always sort of had this argument with her where it's like, no, like, it's not other women's jobs to fix your sons. Like, they need to fix themselves, fix them all within, you know?
Yeah,
and
definitely.
I think that is a weird conversation that we have around men where, like, we're supposed... I think we actually said it on this podcast before, but we're supposed to, like, invent them as women, you know?
Yeah. And nurture that as well. I find with my female friends, so many of them are so much more emotionally developed than my male friends.
Yeah.
I do see, you know, not to generalize, but within my friendship group, I do see a real disconnect there. And I think it's, as a single woman, it's fucking hard in this day and age to find a man who is kind of really in touch with himself and has like done the work the work on himself, like figured out what his shit is, what his demons are, like what's in that, you know, young shadow, and unpick it. And so many of them just haven't, compared to my female friends who I feel like every day are like grinding and they've got the tool kits out and they're like chipping away at it.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. And I think that maybe that again is part of, you know, the outcome of patriarchal culture and just the everything that a man sees mirrored back at him is that he's, you know, perfect and ready and ideal, again, to use the Carrie and Big metaphor. Is Carrie the one that's like got all the problems and the issues and is a nightmare, and Big's just Big with a big shot job, like loving his life,
yeah,
like
you can't change
to
Big
and back.
Yeah.
No, Big's Big, he's set in stone. And it's like, you know, maybe men aren't being presented this idea that they need to go on this kind of...
I think they are only very recently. Yeah. And that's why so many of them are jarred by it.
Now, you know? I think yeah, you're entirely, entirely right that now, I think, specifically because of the rise of feminism and the questioning around the role of masculinity and men, you know, toxic masculinity and the awful impact that that's had on men. Yeah. Maybe now it kind of, that is starting to happen more.
Yeah, and for the most part, I mean, I think a lot of men sort of act like what women are asking of them now is like, okay, you want me to like... Everything I say and do, you want me to cross-reference 9,000 things? And it's like, well, no, but at the same time, yes, because that's what we do.
Yeah.
Like, our level of self-interrogation is so high. Yeah. But I think that's just because of, like, hundreds of years of being socialized to be the right way in a room, you know, and to have the right sort of drag on, you know?
Yeah.
One thing I'm quite eager to talk about with this book is something that people who hate it come back to a lot, which is white privilege.
Yeah.
Where I stand on this is that the entire way through the book, she is exploring all these different cultures, whether it's Italian, Indian, or Indonesian. And at every juncture, she's very much like, I am outside of this and I'm observing it from a journalistic point of view.
Yeah.
And I think she never like pushes anybody under the bus or anything. She never goes for a cheap joke or anything. Even when she's like making cracks about how the Italians are to her, how the Indians are to her, it's coming from a place of deep respect and research.
Yes. Yeah.
But then I think where it gets murkier is when you get a white woman with a lot of money, which she deserves because she worked very hard, going into like somewhere like an ashram and borrowing from Hinduism or Buddhism and borrowing from different cultural traditions. Do you think it gets murkier there?
Yeah, I guess, again, this plays up that question at the beginning about whether is it okay to kind of pick a religion or is it okay for you to decide your approach to God and how you reach him? Is it okay to select different beliefs from different... I think that's a hugely, hugely complex question that we probably need to do a whole podcast series on to even begin to scratch the surface. Mm. I think the white privilege issue in this book is multi-layered. You know, as you say, like on one hand, she was an incredibly successful writer. I didn't realise she'd been shortlisted, you said, for the...
National Book Award.
The National Book Award. And as a result, for her next book, she got paid this fat advance, which was what paid for her to go travelling around the world.
And also she had several books out that I assume she was accruing royalties on.
Yeah. She met David because he was acting in one of her plays.
Yeah.
You know, she was. But then there's the next layer. It's like, okay, but she's a white woman who would have had different opportunities and a different exposure. You know, there's so many layers of white privilege in this book that I think... Yeah, I don't think it can be ignored.
At the same time, though, white privilege is one of those things, like any kind of privilege.
Yeah.
Because obviously everybody is working with different layers and different... Everyone's got a different privilege sandwich, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's a really nice way of looking at it.
Yeah,
that's really nice.
Right?
It feels reassuring. It's like, I have a privilege sandwich and I've got, like, I might have some ham in mine and... You know, no lettuce.
Totally,
you've got the lettuce, but then I've got the pickle. Like, I like that thing of we're all coming at it from different places and we just need to be aware of what's in our sandwich and acknowledge it.
That is so, wow. I said off the cuff, but you've really developed this idea for me. Too often we mistake it as being one of these things where it's like, well, her sandwich is meatier than mine, therefore my sandwich doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, she didn't have to pay for a sandwich. She got a sandwich for fucking free, and I'm over here saving to get on the sandwich ladder.
Totally. Well, it's all just different sandwiches, some of which have problems, you know?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I often might work, like, okay, you know, I'm a white blonde lady, but also I'm Irish, so I get a weird treatment from the English sometimes, and you know, everyone's got their whole... different thing.
Totally.
And also, once you have your sandwich, you can't apologize for it. You know what I mean?
No.
You can be responsible with your sandwich.
Yeah.
You can be observant of other people's less good sandwiches.
Yeah.
But like, sometimes I get the notion that when people claim X privilege, whatever that privilege is, that it's a way of them telling the other person to stop doing what they're doing, like to almost like stop living at all, you know?
Yeah.
Because... if you're coming from a place of white female privilege and you acknowledge it all the way through your book and you research it thoroughly, does that, I think, you know, that's kind of fine. You know, great.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I think it's something that she's aware of. I think it's something that she touches upon. I don't know. I agree. I think she does an immense amount of journalistic research behind all of the places, all of the different kind of belief systems and the cultures.
And it never just feels like service either. It feels like something she's genuinely fascinated by.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know, how people would just be like, and of course things are worse for women of colour. You know, when people just sort of like put these little segues in to like sort of show everyone that they're woke. Yeah. But she's genuinely fascinated by this. This is like heavy research.
Totally. So I guess the Wyan, her and Wyan's relationship is an interesting one. So Wyan is a woman that she meets in Indonesia, in Bali, towards the end of her trip. And, you know, Bali, if you kind of fall out of your marriage, then you're disconnected from the family and you're kind of not part of a tribe anymore. And kind of you're completely then cast out of society. And so her and Wyan meet and their first conversation is about the fact that they're both divorced and how painful and how sorrowful divorces are. And she kind of, they both have this like emotional moment together. But the kind of, their divorces and what's gone on in that relationship is completely different. Like Elizabeth hasn't been cast out of her society because she's a divorcee. Wyan has. You know, Wyan is a victim of domestic violence. Liz isn't. Liz is able to kind of have her own living. Wyan isn't. And there is a kind of, it is, as you say, kind of acknowledged without her sort of saying it crassly. It is acknowledged. Do you think it's complex that then she goes on to kind of fundraise to buy Wyan a house?
It's very interesting, isn't it? So this beautiful relationship with Wyan comes up. And also, Wyan is like this like incredibly noble person who, you know, has adopted two children that aren't her own because they basically have nowhere to go.
She's a skilled doctor. Yeah. Really. She's a medicine woman.
She like solves her UTI.
She's a medicine, but she can't buy a house, so she can't do anything.
She has no mobility within her society.
Exactly, yeah.
So then what happens is that Liz basically goes to an internet cafe and writes a long email to all of her like very wealthy friends back in New York, tells the story of Wyan, says, you know, look, I'm not going to be home for my birthday this year. You would have come out for dinner with me. You would have done this. You would have spent $100 probably.
Yeah.
New Yorkers. So, you know, just can you please just help me raise this money for this beautiful woman.
To help her buy a house for her and her kids.
Yeah. And they do.
Yeah, they raise $18,000.
Fuck.
Which, yeah, when it's converted, is like millions of the Indonesian currency.
But then a weird thing happens that I think you can tell Gilbert herself is uncomfortable writing about, because it's the only time in the whole book where the prose slows down a bit.
Yeah.
Where it loses that fluidity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's like, and then Wyan basically starts conning her a little. Is conning the right word?
Yeah.
Where she's like,
I don't know.
Essentially, she's going, they're looking at all these different plots of land, and sort of Wyan's sort of dragging her feet and kind of trying to get more money out of Liz. It seems.
Okay, I didn't pick that up.
That's kind of what the...
But maybe that's what it is.
And she's like, oh, maybe if I had this much, I'd be able to buy that plot of land, or kind of... And Liz is kind of like a little bit like, oh my God, like, am I being conned here? But she's my best friend in this country. And, blah, blah, blah. And then her boyfriend, Philippe, says to her, look, this is just the Balinese. This is what they do. I can't remember word for word, but something like, it's basically her job to con more out of you and your job to say no. And then Liz figures that out, and she's like, basically puts her foot down with Wyan.
And then
they buy a plot of land and everything's great. But it's like this weird, uncomfortable moment in the book. It's kind of like a grappling with the whole white savior idea, right?
Yeah.
But, and it's like...
And money between friends is complicated anyway. Yeah. You know, if I gave one of my best friends, like, here's 20 grand to help you get, like, that is complicated. It's, you know...
Yeah. And oddly, actually, I read an interview from her a few years later, where like someone's basically asking her, what's life like now that you're a millionaire? and she said, you know, it's been great because like I've had all these friends I've been able to help and stuff. But she also kind of says like, but, you know, it's come with its own curse, because sometimes I've just given people like huge amounts of money to go pursue what I think is their destiny. And then I had to realize that you can't make people do things that you think is their destiny just because you've got lots of money, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, and also like, maybe like money doesn't even enable you to reach your destiny, that's like so much, I don't know.
Yeah.
Just to be financially set doesn't give you the freedom to just do what it is that you want to do. You kind of have to be really determined. You've got to work really hard. Yeah. And yeah, that's complicated, isn't it?
Right.
It feels like somebody kind of coming over to you and being like, here's all the money that you need to go and pursue your dream. And I like...
Yeah. What
percentage of people would then actually go off and pursue their dream, and what percentage would just pop down to Chanel and buy something pretty? I don't know.
Well, weirdly, actually, I don't know, weirdly, maybe it makes complete sense. But, you know, Liz Gilbert's sort of personal life has taken quite a turn in the last few years.
Yes.
In that, you know, Philippe, who she went on to marry, it's not his real name. I can't quite remember his real name. But they announced that they were splitting up about 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people were very sad because they were very invested in this relationship that she then explored more in her book Committed.
Yeah.
And then she announced later that she was in love with her best friend,
yeah,
a woman called Ray Elias.
Yes.
Who was also dying of cancer.
Yeah.
And then they got married, and then she lived for another year or so, and then I think she passed away about 6 or 7 months ago.
Yeah, she did. And Liz kind of looked after her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Rhea was one of those people who apparently came to live in her house in New Jersey, and she gave her some money, and she wrote her book and released her book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wow.
But it's so interesting, isn't it? Like, it's such a strange and tragic, but also kind of wonderful turn for this woman to just realize, aged, I think she's 50 or something.
Yeah. I've heard her talk about Rhea actually on a TED
podcast. I heard
podcast.
That too.
Did you listen to that? Mm. And just, I just, it's fascinating. I love this idea that she was just madly in love with her best friend, kind of, I guess, at first platonically. And then it just kind of, it sounds as if it just built and grew and it became something romantic.
Yeah.
You know, and she talks about Rhea as this kind of most incredible person that she's ever met, this dominating, all-consuming force. Yeah. And I don't know, the love between them also just sounds very pure. But it's an interesting story. And it almost sounds like, it sounded like Rhea got sick and then they got together.
Yeah.
But I don't know whether that timeline sounded like that because of how she talked about it on the podcast. Maybe they were together for longer and it wasn't announced.
From what I've read from a combination of like podcasts,
yeah,
her Facebook thing, her Instagram, you know, there's a lot of Liz Gilbert to consume should you want to consume it.
Yeah.
Is like she realized she was going to lose her best friend and then she realized she couldn't be apart from her for a second more kind of thing.
Yeah.
Kind of like it sort of all sort of exploded in this like, oh my God, I love her so much, you know?
And then they are together romantically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know,
which
right?
I just think that transition of platonic love to romantic love in that intensity is just, I'm like, wow.
All I want to know is more about that.
Yeah.
Right?
How does that, what does that look like? How does that work? I'm write a book on that. I think that's just incredible.
Especially as throughout all, she's a memoirist who's written 2 memoirs.
Yeah.
And lots of journalism that include herself. She's never even hinted to being bi-curious queer in any way.
No.
And to decide at age 50 after 2 marriages with men and countless relationships with men, actually.
And I totally subscribe to this idea that I think I could easily accidentally fall in love with a woman tomorrow. I don't think that kind of the fluidity in that sense is what's shocking or interesting. I think it's the fact that it's her best friend.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I just can't imagine.
No, I know.
Falling in love with my best friend in that way,
right?
As much as I love her, and that idea, that it's that makes it so fascinating to me.
And you and I both have very codependent relationships with our best friends.
Yes, yeah. Can you imagine? It's just,
I know.
Yeah, fascinating. But I'm sure we will sort of hear more. And on that podcast, I love the way that she talks about ideas for writing books and how she believes that kind of ideas are in the air and they're all around and it's an idea sort of comes to you and you're the kind of vessel for it. You create it, but it's not something inside of you. It's not yours. The idea kind of comes and goes, okay, you can be the person to bring me into the world.
Totally.
But
yeah.
If you're not curious and if you don't act on that and start, you know, carving away at bringing that idea into the world, the idea will leave you and it will go to somebody else and somebody else will then write that book or write that TV script.
And it's not a metaphor. She completely believes it.
She's
like, no,
it
this is, when I say magic, I mean, because she wrote this book about creativity called Big Magic. And she's like, no, I'm not being facetious. I think this is literally magic and you can believe that or not believe that, you know?
Yeah. And I find that idea so fascinating. Now, whenever I have an idea to do something, I'm like, oh, quick, you must do the idea
the
now.
Idea.
The idea will find another vessel, another conduit into this world. And we'll find it really stressful. But I just have that idea. And it's true, like this, when you get an idea and it's nagging at you and you're sat out having dinner with friends or whatever, and it's just there in the back of your head, like, come on, come on, come on.
Yeah,
come
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
And I just think that's such a great, it was a great, it's a good, whether it's literal or whether it's a really beautiful analogy, it's this idea that a really nice way of thinking about creativity, I think, and how ideas come to you and ask to be homed by you. And
it's so lovely, isn't it? And it all comes from this initial TED talk she did years ago, which was basically like, why do we associate depression and creativity so much? Why is it that, like, we talk about people being destroyed by their genius or all that? And it basically came from this whole way of thinking from people coming up to her and being like, how are you going to follow up Eat, Pray, Love? Oh, she's like, everyone was suddenly very worried for me all the time. And she was like, you know, I was a writer for 20 years before that book and I liked the job then and I like it now. And and that's what she stumbled on, this idea of like, what if I'm not a genius, but genius comes to you and it passes through you and then it leaves to somebody else, you know?
Yes. And it's also a really nice idea in the sense of, you know, if you're, so say for example, writing books, if you're sat at home and you really want to write a book and you see all these people do it and you just think, God, I can never do that, or they've done that now and it's not for me. Yeah. I think I love that Liz Gilbert idea, because it's like, well, no, there's loads of these geniuses, there's loads of these international bestsellers, they're just floating around in the air and all you've got to do is just ask them, you know, hold your hands out to the universe and sort of be like, I would like to do that, and then work really hard and it could happen. It makes that idea that anyone could have a, you know, Oscar winning movie or a number one bestseller or, you know, a hit record, that it's around in the air for all of us to be the conduit. We just have to play ball and listen and receive. And I just think that's really beautiful.
It is beautiful. It totally is. And do you find that in your career as a literary agent, this is like a comfortable way for you to sort of handle your talent? Like, look, you know, your bestseller is out there. Just literally get your idea fishing net.
Literally. I'm like, the genius is literally floating around. You've just got to... No, I've never used that. I don't think it would go down very well.
No.
It's an interesting kind of... tact to take in your own life, I think, with your own creative projects. It's hopeful.
I think so. To wrap up, I generally ask, you know, who would play who in a film, but it's already been made into a very bad film, which I watched last night and it sucks. But instead, I want to ask you, what would your word be?
No, so hard.
So for listeners, there's this idea in Eat, Pray, Love that every single city on Earth has a word, and no matter what people are doing in that city, if they're eating, sleeping, drinking, or fucking, what they're actually doing is thinking about that word. And in Rome it's sex, and in like New York it's achieve, in LA it's succeed, and basically if you want to live in that city you have to collaborate with that word. Everybody has their own word.
Yeah.
What's
Stockholm's
Abigail's?
Conform.
Yeah, Stockholm is conform.
Yeah, and LA's succeed.
Yeah.
Oh my God, my word. The first thing that came into my head, which I think I meant not, I'm worried now that it makes me sound like full of myself, but intense, but in not always a good way. That was the first thing that came to my head, like intense.
You are intense,
loud and quite full on and like full energy, and people are like, whoa, this intense person. I think maybe that's my word.
No, I don't think that's, I think that's completely fair.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. What's yours? What would be your word?
I think my word is the same as London's word, which is try.
Try.
I'm just always
that's
trying.
That's a nice word. See, that's a really beautiful word.
I think it can be both hopeful and they're like, just try, but also someone can be trying.
Yeah.
And that's London. Do you know what I mean?
It's like
anyone can make it, but also, God, you're a lot, you know?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like both of our words are very companionable, I think.
Yeah, they are. Try, intense and try.
Okay, Abigail, thank you so much for coming in. Is there anything you'd like to plug or talk about before we go?
Just Gleam Titles, which is the literary agency that I work for at Gleam, and you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Gleam Titles and
fabulous.
See all the wonderful books that we've got coming.
Anything in particular you're excited about?
Let's see. Mrs. Hinch's book, which is coming this spring, and also Gina Martin, who's writing a book as well, which I can't tell you what it is yet, but follow Gina. Stay tuned.
Yeah, great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Sentimental Garbage. Tune in next week when we'll be talking to Julie Cohen about Virginia Andrews' Flowers in the Attic. This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me by the podcast at ZarolineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast produced by Hannah Varrell.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.